This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Eric Billingsley, who's GM of SaaS at CloudBees. Eric, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm a software developer for a very long time. I'm a recovered nuclear engineer from before that. And I've worked at companies like eBay, Google, Apple, and then did a startup that got acquired by CloudBees and became the basis of our new SaaS platform.
I've known CloudBees for a long time. We had X came along, which was supposed to be the move from the on-premise into the cloud and everything else. When I talk around, there's a lot of confusion between the traditional product and the SaaS product. Can you give me a view as to what the differences are, how they sit together or don't sit together?
The SaaS product is really intended for cloud-native development. If you are building applications in any language that you're deploying into a Kubernetes cluster, the SaaS platform is perfect for you. We don't take any of the power or the baggage associated with Jenkins along with us. In the back end, we're using a Tecton engine on top of Kubernetes to run the workflows, but we've abstracted that out using a DSL that's based on GitHub Actions. And so they are fundamentally separate worlds. And the reason we did that is, as we talk to customers, we find that essentially their engineers are falling into two camps. You have those who are doing traditional software development. Maybe they're heading towards mainframes or VMs. It's a much more traditional approach to software delivery. Then you have the teams that are really heading towards the cloud. For them, a container-based deployment, a container-based system makes a ton more sense. Rather than thinking of them as competing products, we think of them as two ends of a suite. We see both of those having a place in industry for the next decade or more. We are going to continue to invest in Jenkins. That's got a long life ahead of it. And lots of teams who are working on systems that aren't cloud-native Kubernetes microservices are going to continue to run perfectly well and maybe even better in that environment. Whereas people who want to do 5 deployments a day, orchestrate across multiple clouds, have these massive multi-microservice deployments, the SaaS platform is really intended for that. One of the other interesting bits is we built the SaaS platform so we can deliver it into a customer's environment as well. This gives them best of both worlds. They can run Jenkins, they can run SaaS, and they can own it all inside their network.
There will be customers who are afoot in both camps. They're moving slowly to a full cloud-native environment, but it's going to take them time. They're likely to have Jenkins. They will have looked to use Jenkins for their cloud development. How do you migrate projects across? Because no customer wants to keep that little silo over there and that one over there.
Absolutely. We think about it as a continuum. There are projects that are going to be easy to lift and shift. So you're going to be able to take them. If it's a Java application and you were running it over here and you just want to move it over there, that's very straightforward. We can do that with probably 10 lines in the DSL. That's just a rewrite. Then say you have a governed release process that you want to institute across the board for all your organization. In there, the DevOps team can essentially create what we call a pre-configured action, which takes that entire golden path that they've specified in Jenkins. You can convert that into an actions workflow in our system. You just take the source code from over there, run it through this new platform, and off you go. When you want to go do maybe a mainframe development project, I'm never going to support that in my SaaS. I'm just not. There's nothing about our platform that prevents you from doing that. It's just not the use case we're building for. What we're really trying to do is give you a path to the future and the ability to preserve the bits that are important to you from the past. What we're also seeing is that customers who have really tried to do a conversion like this have never been able to do it in less than 3 years. Because if you've got 2,000 applications, you're going to migrate the first 200 and get 95% of the value out of that. The rest of them, it's probably not even worth the trouble of the migration. We fully expect that we're going to have both camps for a very long time. So as long as you're depending on that mainframe app, or as long as you're depending on that application that you haven't really touched in 2 years, keep it where it is. We're going to continue to support it. One of the nice things we're doing is bundling them so it's a single price for a seat, across both platforms. If you were planning on doing a migration to another tool, you're going to double your costs. Even if you plan to transition 100%, you'll never get there. And you're going to be paying double for 3 years. We're just cutting all that out. You can come to a single vendor, get a single price per seat for each of your developers, and they can move wherever they need to go. The other thing we're doing, which I think is really cool, it's what we call our orchestration capability. We're able to reach out into other automation platforms, whether that's Jenkins, CircleCI, GitHub Action, Argo CD, Spinnaker, or whatever. We can wrap those with an action. You'll be able to have your Jenkins pipeline build all of your code, produce your artifacts, publish them in our system, consume them in our system, deploy them in our system. The two worlds come together. And that's really interesting, because then you're not trying to recreate wheels. You're trying to augment the capability.
Keeping them separate sounds nice. I see where you're going with this. But there are going to be customers where, as part of that foot in each camp, they're going to have code repositories they want to share. Especially APIs. They're still going to need to call those data sets, whether it be cloud native over here, mainframe, or traditional VMs over here. They're going to want those pointers in both places. They're going to want consistency with those pointers. They're not going to want to move devs from A to B, where the devs have got to completely learn how to do things. How have you managed to keep that consistency? Was that part of the original planning, or has that just been something you've had to think about carefully? Because with separate products, people don't necessarily expect coherency.
What we're really trying to do is gather metrics and statistics from both sets of worlds so that you can see the impact of choosing A over B. If the value is there to do a migration, great. If your products just need to talk to each other, guess what? That's what REST APIs and the network is all about. I don't have to do anything on my platform to enable that for you. That's really a choice that you're making as a developer to create your applications in such a way that they will continue to talk to each other, regardless of how they're built and deployed. I don't see that as one of the major issues that the platform needs to deal with. What I do see is that how you manage software development in your organization, how you measure yourself in terms of productivity, how you maintain a well-structured security policy and governance, that needs to be consistent across those two worlds. That's where the integrations that we're doing between the Jenkins world and the SaaS world are key. That gives you a consistent mechanism for comparing the old world and the new world.
I'm really glad you threw the word governance in there, because I've just had a really interesting conversation today talking about compliance and auditing. SOC 2 is around now, and SOC 2 Part 2 means continuous audits, and about time. But it places an incredible strain on development teams. The conversations I've had has been looking at the compliance as a service, the evidence as a service work that's going on at the moment within CloudBees. Now that, as I understand it, is sitting on top of Jenkins. Is that also sitting on top of you, or is it sitting as a separate set of calls that you make? Because it's even more important in a world where we've got such high cadence than it is in a slower world, because any mistake will very quickly become amplified. Any compliance problem will quickly become amplified if we can't get hold of it.
You've touched on essentially our roadmap for next year, which is to take the compliance product and port it completely into the SaaS platform. We talk about it as convergence. All of the one-off products that CloudBees has, they're all heading towards the platform. The idea is to make that the nexus of information. So whether you're running in the Jenkins world, or you're running directly on the platform, or you're using CircleCI, we're going to be able to orchestrate all the data coming from all of those different runtimes and give you that evidence as you go along. Pull the logs from the Jenkins pipeline or from our Tecton pipeline underneath the covers. That's your build log. We're also going to see every pull request, every Jira ticket, every deployment, every approval. All of that information comes together so that when it comes time to actually do your deployment, the person who has to check off in that SOC 2 separation of concerns has the data they need to make that decision. Now, depending on the company, it could be a change review board, it could be an individual, it could be the SRE, it could be anybody. 9 times out of 10, they just say, eh, I guess it's good, click the box and go. Over the next couple of years, that's not going to be good enough. We're going to see a change in how compliance and governance is applied in companies because the stakes continue to go up. Last year, the FDA put out rules for software development for embedded systems in medical devices. Whole new category of governance is coming in to companies that have never dealt with it before. The compliance product is exactly for that sort of world where you need to say, here are the requirements that have been given to us, here's how we verify that we are following those, and here's the evidence that we are continuing to follow it. As a baseline capability in our platform, you're going to get that no matter where you're deploying. So even if it's just pushing artifacts out that get pulled down by your pacemaker, it's going to have all of those checks along the way. You're going to be able to code in the policy that you expect before it goes out to your customer.
Now, one of the challenges once we start looking at bringing compliance in, and it's always been an issue, is interpretation of that compliance. It's not just by the compliance team, but also by developers who tend to look at it and go, meh, throw it in the bin. Can't do that. Too hard. Now they have no choice. They have to do this, and it's long overdue. But we haven't had the technology to enable us to codify that in such a way to make it work. If I think about a more traditional world, where my coding is in the weeks and months, compared to a cloud-native world, where people are looking to spin up in hours and days, one seems to fit our perception of compliance and checks and everything else, one doesn't. Is there a risk that as you apply compliance to a cloud-native platform where people are talking about spin-up in hours and days, that actually it could act as a drag on development? Or how do you streamline it without losing the power that it offers you?
I think the opposite's true. The idea of being able to deliver instantly is all about two things. One, being able to push change out so you can measure it, understand its impact, and decide whether to invest more or pull back. So that's classic A-B testing, multivariate analysis type of web design type work. The other way to think about it is zero-day vulnerabilities. If that pacemaker needs a software update and it's going to take you a month to get it to them, that's not good enough. If you need to get a change out because there's a security issue and someone could hack into your car, it better go out over the air in the next 5 hours. What I'm seeing is a convergence of requirements coming out of governance, where governance is going to mean that we have to go faster. Those critical security issues are coming very quickly now because we're getting much better at finding them. The S-bombs that we're creating are making it much easier for us to find which of our software packages are actually vulnerable. Our ability to then update and push that change out needs to be there so that we can react quickly so that the time to address a critical goes from 30 days to 30 seconds. That's really where I see these two worlds coming together. Whether or not you're doing something that traditionally would be an annual deployment, or whether you're doing a website that needs to be updated 10 times a day, the process can be the same.
So how do we keep that enhancement and that speed on the process? If we think about compliance is not known for being agile, swift. It's set out by lawmakers and civil servants, often who have little comprehension of the technology in the world that they are affecting. And in some ways, that's a good thing, because it means that their worldview isn't affected by the what is possible. Their worldview is affected by the what is required. But that compliance can change slowly, but when it does change, it has to be there immediately. Is it going to be easy to be able to absorb compliance changes, which are never small? They're also always huge and complex, and drop that in? Or do you see yourselves actually running this in a cloud-native world where we start to react to every suggestion as compliance goes through drafts?
Now you're getting into the AI conversation, by the way, but before we even get there, let's think about compliance as a pipeline itself. If I can, as a compliance officer, start to introduce a new set of policies, test them out on a subset of my end users, or maybe have them out on branches and have different branches in the organization leveraging that so I can get the input, and maybe I can get to a point where I can start releasing my regulatory compliance part of the pipeline every day also, we get into a mode where you can start to become much more experimental with your compliance rigor, with the performance of that system, with different tools. Today I'm using SNCC, tomorrow I'm using something else. You can start to try these things out in a way that you can't today. By adopting the GitHub Actions DSL, by using Tecton and Kubernetes to cache and pull down all of these images and speed up the execution, we're getting into a mode where software development itself can actually become the same as the products you're developing in the software. That's where it's getting really exciting, because all of this builds on top of itself. If you think about it in terms of, I need to deliver value quickly, your compliance regime is just part of the value chain. Now, when we go into the AI space, I'm accumulating a ton of information every time I do a build. 90% of it is exactly the same as the previous run. Using AI, we're going to be able to analyze those logs, analyze the data coming back from the scanners, analyze the code itself, the changes themselves, understand the history of what that developer has done in the past, and be able to prepare, essentially, the ticket for operations ahead of time that says, here's the risk level associated with this set of change. And by the way, these five lines, you should go have someone take a look at again.
Now, call me a cynic and call me an old fart, because I'm both.
I am too, by the way.
But I have sat around this industry for years, and we've looked at how we measure developer productivity in terms of the number of errors of that developer, looking at that developer across multiple projects, looking at multiple developers across one project, multiple developers across multiple projects, a big 3D cube where we're supposed to be able to find this stuff. So when you say we can use AI to do this, my brain goes, but hey, we've been having this conversation for 20 years now about how we make this better. And our failure point has always been the analytics. How do we get the right level of analytics with the right history, with the right markers? What changes for you in a cloud world, adding that AI in there to do this, that we haven't historically been able to do?
CloudBees bought GuideRails. I was the CEO of GuideRails when we got acquired. And GuideRails came out of a problem that I was having when I was running internet services operations at Apple. I wanted the iTunes team to be able to deliver software much more quickly. We did a deep dive on the existing process. We did a deep dive on how to solve the issues that we were running into. And the precursor of GuideRails was the outcome of that project. The big thing that I was dealing with when I created GuideRails and what's now in the new SaaS platform is the idea that by bringing everything together into one place and having a single data plane with a consistent set of protobufs that are backing up all that data in a consistent way, we can start to build that history. And so regardless of what your build tool is, regardless of what your scan tool is, we get all of that into a canonical form. And by doing that, we start to build the history, build the difference. It becomes a more tractable problem. AI is really good at taking some loose data and giving you a summary of it. It's not great at comparing tool A to tool B. By standardizing how we represent that internally, and by the way, every bit of data that we push into the system is done via a public API that any action can implement. So you can bring in whatever tools you want. As long as you publish it in so that we get the attestation, as long as we get the data, it becomes part of your record. By doing that, you start to create a consistent data set that can be analyzed, and it becomes a much more tractable problem.
How do you then turn that to things like predictive analytics? Because clearly, if I can see that this developer regularly has a problem with this, or this team has a problem with that, or this type of platform, this speed which we're trying to do with this business unit, generates the same problem again and again, or generates evolutions of that same problem, we should be able to head it off at the pass. We can change our processes, our tests, the way we look at compliance. All these things suddenly become up for grabs. Is that where you're going? Is that what you think we're going to achieve?
That's part of it. And we're probably not going to go there tomorrow. But we'll go there over the next few years. What I think is more fundamentally interesting is that AI is going to level the playing field for the developers themselves. So you were talking about comparing developers. I don't even want to get into that space because it scares developers off when they know they're being graded by the system. I don't even want to do it. What I want to do is make sure that we're arming them with AI so that your junior developers actually get the superpowers so that they are almost equivalent to your best developers. Now, what that's going to do is a few things, and it's something I don't think we're talking about in the industry enough right now, which is your most senior unicorn developers start to become less important to you. And that's a terrifying thing for a lot of groups. What it does do, though, is it allows you to start thinking about how do I standardize and not let the unicorn developers in my organization drive all of my policies.
But there's a challenge with this, isn't there? I've been involved in expert systems since the mid-1980s with Expertech XI Plus, Prolog, and a bunch of other things. And the lesson I learned very quickly was that you can't easily extract information from a subject matter expert. It's a major problem in cybersecurity today when we look at the attacks. Unless I have somebody who understands that culture of the person who's being attacked, it's very hard for me, if I come from a very different culture, to understand why they would fall for that attack. If I don't understand the engineering of a nuclear power station, I may not understand how that particular attack on a set of pumps, which are cooling it, are causing a cascade failure. I simply see pump issues. I wouldn't see it as an attack that's creating additional issues for me. So extracting that subject matter expert is incredibly hard. It's why we have unicorn developers. I've known a few in the years. People who can walk in, look at my problem, write me one line of code that would take me 1,000 lines of code to write and half a year to understand the problem. They are the savants of the industry. And every company has one or two. The bigger you are, the more you're likely to have them. And we're scared of them. So how do you democratize what is in their head if you're going to lift those junior developers and give them that without basically putting an interface into the back of their head and attaching some wires?
I don't think we're going to go that far. I think GitHub Copilot is actually making some pretty good strides in the direction of at least getting you to something that's semi-functional code that's pretty efficient, too. I use it daily, and I've been writing code since about, 1993. I'm impressed with what it comes back with, and it almost never works, but that's going to get better very fast. Where I see the humans adding value is actually around the architecture, the design, the whys, the whats, and the hows of solving a customer problem. Because it's going to be a while before AI understands all my systems, understands how to interpret a customer problem, and turn that into a coded solution. I think that's decades away, if ever. What I see is our experts in the organization are going to continue to add value in that space. It's converting that customer requirement into an action plan. And then our junior developers are going to have the AI to help them create that off the plan. Our unicorns don't go away. They just evolve into architects and designers. What I worry about are those architects and designers who have to spend all their time coding because they're the only ones capable of doing it.
But isn't this a revisitation of 1988 and object orientation, where we would have a few unicorn developers in our business that would write every object and business analysts would assemble them? If you're saying that these people now become our architects and the design, are we also then saying that our developers are a little more than a bricklayer? They're just putting things together and building a wall, building a house, building a shed.
I don't think so. It's all levels of abstraction. Object-oriented programming was just a level of abstraction on top of the basic functional programming. What we're heading towards is a division of labor where your junior developers are going to be able to take a blueprint and build a house. Right now, that unicorn developer, he's doing the framing too. What we're going to see is that by making the individual junior developers much more capable on their own because they're augmented with the AI, they're going to be able to take over much, much more of the work. That's going to give us a huge amount of flexibility in terms of how we bring our engineers up, how we distribute our work, how we translate requirements across the organization, because you can start to be much more loose. That allows us to be much faster as well. If you have to articulate to the nth degree, this is how I want it built, that's 6 months of definition for 3 months of programming.
We've both done projects like that, right?
Oh, of course. And we know every time you do it, you designed it wrong. The toilet, when you flush it, it comes up out of the sink or something. Where I see this going is common sense. That's the key that engineers are going to need to bring to the table. Because the AI is going to produce code based on what you asked it to do. And if you didn't ask it right, you're going to get some really bad results.
So a couple of things here. Let's deal with the issue of the code first. There is nothing terrifies me more than the thought of somebody grabbing a prompt, going to a Gen AI solution and saying, hey, I've got a security problem. Give me a piece of code to solve this. And then picking up that code and cutting and pasting it. We've seen it for decades with sample code. And no matter how much you and I, as experienced developers, look at it and say, yeah, the code's never quite right when I get it, there are going to be people who are going to throw it in there and wait for the test to kick it out. How do we build the processes around this, be they from the security team, be they from the compliance team, be they just from general good housekeeping processes, to stop that happening?
It all comes down to the tests. The tests won't catch it if you didn't build the test properly. When we talk about compliance, one of the big pieces of compliance that we have to drive in is how we do our testing. Whether or not you have adequate unit testing, whether or not you have adequate integration testing and end-to-end testing of your applications, that's the area where most people aren't doing enough. As we start to free people up, that 30% that Anuj talked about earlier, that's how much time engineers get to spend actually writing code. As we expand that, the place that's going to consume it is around testing and validation. It's making sure that what we're building actually is solving the problem it was intended to solve. And AI is actually really good at that. So it's 10 times better at writing a test for a function than it is at writing the function already. I'm expecting that these things go hand in hand. And an AI can always compete against itself also. You can write tests that basically break the function. So I'm really expecting that this is an arms race between the testing and the development that's going to ultimately result in a much better set of products that we're producing.
Talking to Patrick Dubois just now, he made the comment that maybe we never actually cut and paste the code in. Maybe we just cut and paste the prompt in.
That's possible. I could definitely see that happening. What I think is more likely, though, is that we're going to get much better at creating reusable libraries. One of the problems that I've found consistently across larger organizations is their ability to share code in a meaningful way is very poor. When I was at Google and developing software there, the most interesting part of the whole system was the monorepo that they had built and the mechanisms that they had built around who managed what and how you found code to leverage elsewhere. If you wanted to know how to convert Fahrenheit to Celsius, you could write that function, or you could leverage the one that someone had already written. If you wanted to understand the mapping of postal codes and addresses, there's a library for that. What I expect is we're going to start, especially with our SaaS platform, building that map of all the software that's available in the organization, such that when you write your prompt, it doesn't rewrite the function for you, it finds the function for you. We're going to get into a mode where you don't have to be the expert on the entire code base. The code base comes to you. And that's going to allow a fundamentally different way of working for a lot of teams, because it doesn't turn into this thing where I have a problem here and I solve it in 10 different places. I solve it once, and everybody gets the solve.
Which was always the promise of object orientation, wasn't it? You would write a function and everybody would use it, except we knew very quickly nobody would ever use it all the time, because somebody wants it in green and somebody wants it in blue, and then somebody wants it to be a different font. Life is never easy, even when we make it elegant. Life is never easy. But the other thing that came to mind there was, should we, in these early stages when we start to do this, start to mark that code as machine-generated? In the same way as we, when we started to do these applications that would allow us to describe an app that would generate the base code for us, we'd then customize and we'd have guard sections. If we're going to go down this route, should we not be saying to people, okay, when you do that, even if you tweak it, even if you correct it, it needs to be marked in a block to say that this was AI-generated code.
I've thought about that in the past. My experience up to this point tells me that we're not at a point where we need to do that yet, because the code that's being generated is imperfect enough that the humans are always actually tweaking it before it goes through. And so in that mode, it's really the human that's responsible for it. When I do the git blame, I don't want the answer to be GitHub. I want the answer to be Joe. Because at the end of the day, that's the value of that software developer, is that they have certified that this code is going to work for the use case that I've put forward. And so as long as we're in that mode, I think it doesn't hurt to have the attestation or have the comment that says this is co-developed. But I think we're a ways away from being in a mode where we trust that code yet.
And I wasn't necessarily saying we trust it. I like the idea of co-developed. And the reason I particularly like that is because we know from what we've seen in other uses of Gen AI that people will be lazy. Lawyers who go out there and look for fake case law without knowing it's fake case law and then are stupid enough to stand up in court, argue it and get caught. People who jump on LinkedIn and say, hey, I just saved myself 5 days doing the presentation for the company accounts. You're a listed company fella. Why did you do that? More importantly, why did you boast about it? I kind of get why you do it. I don't get the boast. When developers, we don't need to be masking a lack of skills by doing this. Actually, we should be using that to build their skills. So I think there's a real opportunity here for us to be able to identify where somebody's lacking skills or somebody's needs some assistance to help lift them up.
I totally agree with that. But where I think the rubber really meets the road is around code reviews. Anything that we can do within our platform, within AI, to augment the code review process so that people understand where the potential issues are and highlight those for them so that they know to focus on those spaces adds a ton of value. Where I get a little more worried is when you have a loose pull request mechanism and code review mechanism in your organization. Partner programming, it's been shown to be much more effective than individual engineers trying to build things. When your co-programmer is an AI, you take on a lot more responsibility. The code review process is still the mechanism that most organizations use and we use to guarantee that someone's not making a fundamentally flawed mistake when they introduce a new piece of code. That's going to continue to be an important part of the process. AI is going to add data to that process. I know in our product it will. Anything we can do to make that process better for the developers is going to be nothing but good.
One challenge here, we talked about this separation between on-premises and cloud native, is that we need to have speed in cloud native. Do you see this use of AI as being something that will absolutely accelerate cloud native and is best suited for cloud native, or does it fit all of our coding paradigms?
I think it fits all. And the reason I say that is the same as I talked about earlier, which is it doesn't matter what your planned release frequency is when the 0 day comes through. You have to deal with it then. If you have to be in a position where you can release within the next 5 hours, you have to have systems that allow you to release in the next 5 hours. It doesn't matter whether you're building for cloud native or building for the mainframe. A critical flaw is a critical flaw, and it has to be addressed. And so that speed, the techniques, the AI, the process, it has to be consistent across all those different use cases. Otherwise, you get into a mode where half your world works one way, half your world works another way. I really don't care about which engine you use to exercise the pipeline, as long as the pipeline capabilities, the governance of that system, and the metrics you're pulling out of it are consistent. Because then you can measure your apples and oranges, and you can actually compare them.
So I put everybody on the spot towards the end of a podcast. Give me three things that you see coming up that are either going to enhance and affect cloud-native development, or AI, or compliance. Choose your poison, and give me three things that people need to pay attention to.
Let's break down the process. The first thing is around planning. I find that most organizations do a really poor job of planning. The number of times that a Jira or an Epic comes and it's a one-liner, it's go build the greatest thing in the world. Excellent. How do I go do that? I think AI is going to allow us to actually get better at articulating our requirements because it can generate them quickly and then we can edit them quickly. The tyranny of the blank page is something that we can get past now. And that is, to me, the key value of an AI, or at least generative AI. So that's the first thing that people need to pay attention to, is requirements definition coming from AI and a person is going to be a critical change that needs to get introduced in a lot of organizations. The next piece is really around tests. How you test your code is almost more important than the code itself. What I find is that for every line of code someone builds, they're going to need 3 to 10 lines of code to test it. We don't value it in the same way. We just don't. AI's ability to spit out code, that, especially for tests, is actually pretty good. I'm blown away by GitHub's Copilot's ability to generate good tests. That's the place that people should focus first. If you're thinking about whether or not to use Copilot, go do it. But concentrate on the testing side first. Finally, deployments. There's a whole lot of work going on in this space from a whole lot of vendors, but it really comes down to validation. The weakness that I see in the industry today is that people aren't checking whether or not their code is actually running as it's supposed to run before they finish the deployment. A basic health check before you roll the next one and the next one and the next one makes all the difference. If we can come up with better techniques to actually handle those three use cases, you're going to see an order of magnitude improvement in an organization's ability to deliver good code for their customers.
Eric, thank you for spending time with me.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.